This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Hope you're well. Great to have you with us as we listen back to some of the best bits, hearing advice from the experts, your stories too, and making sure you are living your best life. To answer your legal questions, we were joined this week by Ludmilla Maliver, looking at Ponzi schemes and scams, which are sadly rife right now. And some of you have definitely been affected. What are her advice for keeping up to date on the latest legal requirements? And she was taking your questions too. And have you felt perhaps more stressed than ever before? Data suggests we are all living on the edge. Can we even train our brains to be protected against stress or not feel it at all? Brain trainer Dr. Upasana Gala was on the line and she had an exercise for us all to try. And with many people looking for jobs right now, it's a very, very competitive market. Have you been sending out that CV, sending applications through online portals, but simply not getting a response? We had life coach, career coach Zita Yarwood on the line, talking about how to get your online applications noticed.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Guys, I really can't stress this enough. This is one of the busiest shows on your radio. It is your free legal clinic. Joining us on the line now is our resident legal expert, it's Ludmilla Maliver from HPL Maliver & Pluka, as we look behind the headlines and as well, most important, take your questions too. And they really can be about absolutely anything. You could be having a tough time with a tenant, could have a landlord who's trying their luck. It could be to do with wills, divorce, employment, redundancy. Ludmilla live on the line. How are you?
I am well. Great to hear your voice again. I missed you last time.
I know. I missed you too. It's great to have us reunited on the airwaves. And as I said, always a really, really busy show. And I'm going to be picking your brains well and truly over the course of the next hour. We are going to be looking behind the headlines. We've had a number of questions, several about scams, actually, that seem to be running across the city right now. So I'm keen to get your take on those. But let's look at the news recently. Big news. The UA cabinet has amended bankruptcy law. What do we need to know, Ludmilla?
Yes, well, this is a bankruptcy law that was introduced in 2016. And what's important to highlight is this particular law, because it relates to bankruptcy, it actually relates more to companies versus individuals. So it's not a personal insolvency law, but rather for companies. And the amendment, which was introduced on just a few days ago, on the 25th of October, ultimately amends or introduces new circumstances under which companies that are in distress may be able to either opt for grace period or additional financing or solicit help of the courts and various liquidators to help them ultimately restructure their businesses in circumstances such as the pandemic and other emergency type situations such as natural disasters, for example. So the idea of this particular amendment is to introduce specific language related to emergency situations. In other words, when businesses suffer and go through challenging time because of these challenging situations rather than or instead of just their own perhaps either mismanagement or just business, regular business difficulties. So it's emergency situations that are include in particular pandemic and other natural disasters, for example. So the objective of this amendment is to allow businesses who are suffering, in particular because of COVID-19, mm-hmm. Perhaps to gain some extra time to help them restructure their businesses and continue to operate while giving assurances to the creditors that their interests are protected. I mean, that's just kind of the overarching spirit of it, but the details of the amendment are yet to be disclosed.
Have you, Ludmilla, seen businesses going bust due to the pandemic and then having to deal with the law? So kind of compounding their stress, I'm sure.
For sure. I mean, we've seen a lot of businesses that are certainly either considering going through some kind of bankruptcy or just closing of the business or selling off the business. We haven't ourselves gone with to courts to actually apply this particular law, though we have done so for individuals on the back of the insolvency law. But certainly a lot of businesses are considering doing it, and very few businesses actually want to file for bankruptcy, because bankruptcy itself and the law, the way it's drafted, it really is perhaps more suitable for bigger businesses with bigger operations, because it's a fairly involved process, as you would imagine. So you need to ultimately file a case with the court and appoint a liquidator and get all the creditors to the table and try to negotiate with them. So it's a fairly extensive, as you would imagine, operation. Therefore, for smaller businesses, it's not as commercially feasible or even practical as it is for bigger businesses. But yes, definitely a lot of businesses are going through this right now, and everyone is trying to figure out what do we do short of filing for bankruptcy.
Now, let's talk scams and Ponzi schemes, because we have had a number of messages on this who, well, coming from quite different viewpoints, and as I said, you can be anonymous. A message here from Renjith about his friend saying, friend has been a victim of a Ponzi scheme. The guy has taken his money, left the country. Turned out he didn't have a registered company, nor did he have a work visa. My friend is doing some digging, but in terms of recovering his money, he doesn't know where to start. Would appreciate any advice on this. Thank you.
Well, before I answer the question, let me, because it offer my own story of perhaps a type of a Ponzi scheme or a scam rather. So, and this is, by the way, the second time around that we have been subjected ourselves as a business or as a law practice. So, and it usually happens at times, it's sort of when the economy is vulnerable, as is the case right now. And so we have been approached, this is, don't forget, second time around, we have been approached by what was supposed to be some sort of like a media channel or a TV station. And so they said, we want to do an interview on your, basically because you're an entrepreneur in the industry and you've been very successful, you've contributed to the UAE business environment, very, very sort of general statements. But long story short, they ultimately offered to come and take an interview and feature the firm on various platforms. And so this happened to us last year when they came in the door and I said, okay. And then right before they set up the whole sort of professional looking setup, and then they said, okay, well, we want money. So
When they were with you, when the cameras were set up and you'd put your time aside, that's when that request came in.
Exactly.
That's outrageous. Also, that's a lot of hassle. I mean, they're pretty confident that you're going to say, yeah. I mean, can I ask how much they're asking for?
I, to be honest with you, so this was last year. So I think like $5,000, 15,000, you know, whatever you can offer sort of a thing. But I think 5,000 was the starting price. But as you said, and so I think there's a lot of psychological kind of pressure, if you will, because they set up, they've got the lighting and the camera pointing at you, and you got a microphone, and then it's kind of in the thick of that. All of a sudden they're like, well, you know, we're sort of a low budget, so and so, and obviously you wouldn't mind contributing. And when I said, well, this was not part of the deal. I know. So I said, I didn't sign up for this. So sorry, I'm not the right interviewee for you. So guess what they did? They just packed up and left.
Good. Get out.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but that shows you basically that they had no other legitimate reason than that. But since then, so they've come back this year. And since then,
Email is set up, same company name.
The thing is they call from different numbers, you know, they make you sound really, really like valuable and important. Anyway, since then we've traced them through different social media channels, and apparently they have scammed a number of businesses exactly that same way. So obviously there's something that has worked for them, and I just thought it would be an interesting story to share with the listeners, because these scams exist.
It really makes me laugh that they would try and scam a law firm. Like, that takes stones. That really does.
But I think they did not know. I think they were such rookies.
Okay.
So they didn't even really connect the dots.
But as you say, this would not be in place. They would not be showing up to workplaces and putting all the admin in behind the scenes if people hadn't paid that money in the past. That is extraordinary.
Well, that's it.
A question here saying, can a company with whom you have a contract add a clause to the contract on a monthly invoice without getting your permission or acknowledgement? What's your quick take on that?
In short, no, because a contract required cannot be unilaterally amended. So it requires the other party's consent to amend any or introduce any new terms.
Good to know.
It's unenforceable.
And a message saying an overseas company is threatening to take action to recover $3,500 for services that they were not happy with. Can they take action from an overseas court judgment?
In short, no. A contractual dispute is very much jurisdiction based. And unless the agreement itself provides for a court in that jurisdiction where the company is based, then they would not be able to really actually bring a case. And even then, there's also personal jurisdictions of the company, the recipient of the services, for example, or the provider of the services does not have personal jurisdictional connection to that other jurisdiction. The courts in that other jurisdiction will not accept it. But this is more of a legal position, but a practical position is that no one will bring a case for 3,000 dirhams from overseas. I mean, it's just not even practical to bring a case here.
It was $3,500, but again, as you say, not huge.
Yeah. I tell you, just the service of process, you know, for the company to file a case abroad, they have to serve a party here, and that itself could take more than 6 months to do and cost quite a bit of money. So that itself is prohibitively expensive. So
good,
not
to
likely.
Know. Okay, thank you for that, Ludmilla. Message here saying, I have a question. Sorry, it's a bit extreme, but that's what we're facing nowadays. Employees are engaged with travel as part of their expected job descriptions. Due to the perceived risks of COVID-19, they don't wish to travel. What is the employer's legal position? And if the employee travels and gets stuck or even dies of COVID-19, what are the consequences?
Well, I mean, at the end, it depends on the contract. So if the contract for the particular employee is specifically mentions that the travel is a necessary part of their job description, then they refuse to do it, and although they have a legitimate reason to do so, but given where things stand right now, if the company provides for or makes all the other amendments or concessions to the employee, such as making sure that they do the test, it pays for the test, for example, and it makes sure that they do quarantine and whatever other health and safety measures that do exist today, because other people do travel. So as long as the company can show that it has provided all these concessions to the employee and then the employee still refuses to travel, then the company can terminate. Because ultimately what's happening here is that the employee does not want to perform the very core of their obligation. Mm-hmm. Now, the employee may want to bring a case for arbitrary dismissal, and they may have a chance there, but it depends on what the company can prove in terms of showing that this was necessary for them to terminate this employee because they do refuse to perform their job, which other employees would. So it's not like we are in the war zone right now and nobody else is traveling. So the world is kind of moving ahead. So I think the company here has a very good argument, provided they do it correctly, to ultimately fight or challenge the arbitrary dismissal compensation if the employee were to bring this case to court.
Thank you, Ludmilla. And very last question of the day. And I don't know if think it's going to be a simple yes or no, but let's see if we can squeeze it in before One Direction. Vince is saying, my mental health problems are clearly caused by my work, but mental health isn't covered by my insurance. Is there a legal way of making my employers pay for my therapy?
Well, the best way, as the listener said, would be the insurance. But if the insurance clearly excludes that, then the only other way to have a chance to perhaps have the company compensated is to bring a case for damages as part of mental health being a work-related injury. And as long as you have proof for that, obviously from a doctor's notes and receipts, then you could have a chance in court to recover all the payments that you have had to pay out of your own pocket for fixing your condition.
Okay, Ludmilla, thank you so much. It was a busy hour. I really appreciate, as ever, all your expertise and insights. And we'll talk to you very soon. Thanks, Ludmilla. Ludmilla Mather from HPL Malvo and Palooka.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, be honest, guys, how are your stress levels? Stress at work is a real problem, and it is the concern of 85% of Dr. Upasana's clients right here in Dubai. And since March, the pandemic has relegated many of us to our homes. The monotony of social distancing, being tethered to the same few rooms, can often result in overwhelming stress and anxiety. But there are some ways to manage your mood and even protect and train your brain during these trying times. Dr. Gala is on the line from Evolve Brain Training now to tell us more. Dr. Gala, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. As I said, a huge number of your clients reporting more stress than ever before. And I have to say, that's not surprising. 2020 has been a shocker for many, many people. What happens in the brain when we get stressed?
Absolutely. First of all, Helen, thank you so much for having me back.
My pleasure.
It was so much fun the last time. stress is really a big problem, especially this year, you know, with everybody, and especially with work stress. The biggest thing about all of this current stress levels is the uncertainty. You know, our brain really loves certainty. Everything that our brain does is basically based on predictions. So if you are even driving down a road, you're following your GPS, you predict there's going to be a turn, so you're going to make a turn. Mm-hmm. So every second, your brain is making these millions of predictions and then changing behavior based on, you know, updated new information. Now, what's happening in the current situation is that there is nothing to predict on. You know, everything is so uncertain. The whole situation we're dealing with has never happened before, so we don't have any past things to base our assumptions or predictions on. And we kind of have to be in this fluid state. So our brain has to like shift from, you know, prediction kind of mode to this fluid, agile state, ready for whatever may come at you. So in order to be that way, you have to kind of activate your fight and flight response. And there is a neurotransmitter called norepinephrine, which is highly activated in this state. That is fine when you're going through, you know, small periods of stress and you have to be really alert and ready to respond in any way. But the problem currently is that this has been going on for months, mm-hmm. and we don't know when it is going to end. So it's really hard for the brain to deal with and like make peace with the fact mm-hmm. that you are not going to know how to deal with this, and you have to kind of deal with this uncertainty for an unpredictable amount of time.
I think that's exactly right. You know, a lot of people I speak to aren't necessarily reporting these, you know, very stressful episodes. It's more just like a low level of stress constantly, you know, a thrum of feeling overwhelmed and uncertain and frustrated and powerless. And this really, you know, it really adds up, as you mentioned there, the fight and flight mechanism in the brain. And, you know, we know that going back thousands, if not millions of years, you know, this was to protect us. It was to have that shot of, well, action or inaction to protect us against things like, you know, saber-toothed tigers. Not many saber-toothed tigers when we're working from home, but there are other sources of stress right now, that job insecurity, reduced salaries, the lack of travel, the social disconnection. So what are you seeing when clients are coming in? What are some of the things that they're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. The things you mentioned, I mean, I just had a client come in yesterday and he just came back from a staycation and found out that, you know, his salary was cut by 40%. And, you know, he was expecting some change, but this is like way more unexpected. And again, he has to just, you know, it's uncertain things. Like, you know, something is going to happen, but you don't exactly know what. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned lack of travel and social disconnection. So that actually has a much bigger impact than we realize, because feeling lonely is the social equivalent of feeling physical pain. So it, in fact, even triggers the same pathways in the brain that are involved in processing emotional responses to physical pain. So it's, it changes your physiological brain, and it changes the way you react, and it changes your behavior, and changes a lot of other things, even though it seems like not a big or any physical thing, but it actually makes physical changes in your brain.
And there can be real physical knock-on effects to stress as well. You know, we know there are other areas that it affects, you know, sleep being a really key one, and there's numerous data around bad sleep leading to heart issues, you know, you mentioned lack of, you know, motivation, a lack of focus. So it's not to be underestimated at all. So my question to you is, how can we protect our brains from stress and anxiety? Is that possible?
Yes, absolutely, it is possible. So, you know, all of these things that you mentioned, the lack of motivation is actually one of the most common complaints that I get from clients in the last 4 or 5 months, including the disrupted sleep, which kind of are kind of related. And they all report that it's the lockdown that was the trigger for, you know, these effects coming out. So many of them were always suffering through some sort of anxiety or even slight levels of depression or stress, but they were able to manage it or, you know, deal with it and go about their lives in a normal way. But the lockdown kind of brought up all of these other things and made it much bigger, and they actually had to face these issues face on for the first time. It's same with the lack of motivation. People working from home, our brains are kind of tuned to, you know, the environment. So when we are working in the office, our brain associates working and work with being in that office environment. When we're working from home, or when, you know, when you're at home, your brain associates home with being relaxed and, you know, winding down. But when a lot of people started working from home, mm-hmm. the brain kind of was thrown into this, like, oh, what? I have to work at home. I thought
this was my sanctuary and now it's a place of stress. Right, I think that's exactly right. I'm ready. I'm ready to feel de-stressed, Doctor. Can you give us some of the tips and solutions that, that you have recognized throughout your research and expertise?
Absolutely. So one of the things that I always recommend to my clients is something called restructuring thoughts. So I'll explain what that is. So we don't usually notice, but our thoughts really affect our emotions. And when something negative happens, you automatically get a thought. And more often than not, it's negative in nature. And this phenomenon has a very creative name. It's called negative automatic thought. So identifying these thoughts and reframing them helps to reduce these negative emotions. So say, for example, you had, you know, your boss yelled at you and immediately you think, oh, my God, I'm going to get fired. Everything is going to fall apart. Next time you have a thought like this, you challenge it with more rational thoughts. Mm-hmm. Like, there is a very minimal chance that this will happen. Yes, it is a possibility, but not a probability. And I can't live in the realm of possibility because anything is possible always, all the time, right? So you deal more with the probabilities. And if you've dealt with difficulties in the past, then, you know, remind yourself of those times that you were able to cope with them and you are here today. So if you could do it before, you can do it again. And we can't control the future, but we can control our own actions. So even if you think about what is the worst that can happen, think about how you would cope during that time. And then put your energy and your focus on the things that are in your control. You know, if you are worried about losing your job, spend more time making connections on LinkedIn or, you know, networking or, you know, honing a second skill or stuff like that that will actually help you rather than in this ineffective, worrying state of mind.
Something that I think has been really effective has been writing these things down. I think, you know, sometimes if you let your thoughts spiral, you can just start catastrophizing. But if you actually write down what's bothering you, it could just be a couple of bullet points. And actually seeing it there in black and white, it's not as bad as what you might have initially
thought. Exactly, because in your head, things are always so magnified. Mm-hmm. And then you actually put it on paper, you might realize, number one, they're not as bad. Or number two, even if they are bad, it helps you prioritize your problems or your fears or your concerns. And once you put it on paper, it goes from, only if you can see the problem in front of you, you can come up with solutions for them. So it turns from ineffective worrying to active problem solving. And it can also help you track any symptoms you have day by day so you can recognize the triggers of your anxiety or of your fears. And once you know the triggers, you can learn ways to better control them or avoid them if that's a possibility. So writing things down on paper has really, you know, it has so many benefits, and it's an activity that I actually started doing and I recommend to almost everybody that comes to me, especially if you're somebody who suffers with making things much bigger than they are in their head. And a lot of us go through that in these days.
Now, you obviously specialise in brain training and doing some brain exercises. Are we able to give one a try now, please?
Yeah, I'll just mention one that actually at my centre, what we do is neurofeedback therapy. So this actually allows your brain, whatever is dysregulated in the brain, so anything that is making you anxious or anything that is causing you to have fears or phobias, we allow the brain to regulate itself. So it's a NASA patented technique that we use EEG, to monitor your brain waves and then allow your brain to regulate itself using this technology. But apart from that, yes, we can do some brain exercises right now. You know, the exercise I'm going to talk about right now, it helps you activate the right side of your brain. And the right side of your brain generally is the more creative side. And it helps you improve problem-solving skills and also helps you with divergent thinking. So being able to think of ways, you know, think of solutions, creative solutions outside the box. And it helps you look at a problem just differently and helps you change perspective. So if there's a pen around you.
A pen?
Helen, you can just, yeah, you know, or anything, pen or pencil.
By the way, guys, don't do this if you're driving.
No, actually, you can do this if you're driving.
Oh,
so,
goodness.
Yeah,
okay.
You just have to. So you and I, we're going to come up with 10 alternative uses for a pen, apart from using it for writing. What else can I use this pen for?
Okay, I use pens to keep my hair out of my face. You could use a pen to spear some food, like a one-handed chopstick situation. You could use a pen. Do you know what? My personal trainer uses pens to help kind of focus the mind before doing an exercise. So passing it between your fingers as a kind of a way of relaxing you.
Yeah, that is true.
What else could you use a pen for?
You can use it as a drumstick.
Yes, you could definitely use it as a drumstick. You could do it to strengthen your foot muscles. We've had a podiatrist on the show before who says if you squeeze a pen underneath your toes, it's great for your arches. Oh, so there's a little every day's a school day. You can add that to your list.
Yeah, you can use it to stir something.
Yes, you could. You could use it to have a tiny jousting match with somebody else. That's got to
all
be almost 10.
Hit somebody if they're annoying you or
yes,
get their attention.
I would never do that, but you could. Okay, right. So that's got to be almost 10, Doctor.
Yeah. So, you know, this exercise you can do with, you know, anything. You pick up a mug, you pick up a fly swatter, whatever. And what you're doing is you're allowing your brain to think in divergent ways, which helps you in real life with creative problem solving. And when people are stressed, their problem solving skills also decrease because there's a part of your brain, the amygdala, that basically takes over your prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is the front of your brain that is responsible for making rational decisions, for focus, for motivation, for coming up with problem-solving solutions. So if we strengthen our prefrontal cortex using exercises like this, then next time the amygdala is activated and tells your prefrontal cortex to shut up, the prefrontal cortex will be like, no, I am not going to shut up. I'm going to make sure we make rational decisions. And
love
it helps you deal with your anxiety better.
Doctor, thank you so much for discussing this today. I think it's really important that we even acknowledge that we're feeling a bit more stressed than usual. It's obviously the first step to making some changes. And you can be found at Evolve Brain Training. Dr. Gala, thank you so, so much.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking online applications now, how to get noticed. If you're looking for a new job and you're not getting a response. Delighted to be joined on the line by Zita Yarwood. She's a career coach, a life coach, and an executive coach. Zita, how are you?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Having a great week. I think everyone's looking forward to that long weekend. So 4-day working week, everyone's in a good mindset. And I'm really keen to pick your brains on something that seems to be coming up an awful lot right now, which is I'm putting my CV out to lots of people. I'm applying for hundreds of jobs, but I'm not getting a single interview. It seems to be a really common complaint right now. And we know the job market, well, it's pretty candidate heavy and perhaps a bit light on the actual jobs. But there could be some things that might be fundamentally wrong in the way that you're presenting yourself and the way that you're applying. So I just wondered, what have you been hearing on your extensive LinkedIn network and from clients as well?
Yeah, I mean, they've basically been saying exactly the same thing and the degree of frustration that comes with that, you know, sort of spending 5-6 hours a day applying to jobs online and not getting any response. And that could be seriously demotivating. Mm-hmm. LinkedIn seems to be very problematic in the sense of not in other countries, in other cities of the world, you might get around about, let's say, 100 to 200 applicants per role. On LinkedIn, you can see numbers of up to about 4,000-5,000 applications per role in Dubai because it's a global hub, right? So a lot of people from all over the world are applying to be here. So the number of applications is crazy. And not only that, the majority of them are completely irrelevant and they're just clogging up the system.
That's what I was going to ask you. Surely those 5,000 people aren't all good candidates for that job. Is it a bit of a scattergun approach in many cases?
Absolutely. I mean, some of these people are desperate and in desperate times, they're just trying that, you know, they're just doing what they can and they're just applying to every single job online. And you can completely understand that. Unfortunately, it just means that for the candidates that are a really good match for that role, it just becomes, you know, harder for their CV to get noticed.
So how can you stand out from the crowd? Is it a case of making sure you're incorporating keywords? Is it a case of making sure your LinkedIn profile is ticking certain boxes? What are some of your top tips, Zita?
So it depends on which strategy you're using. If you're looking at job adverts specifically, you have to kind of understand how the job portals work. So if you can imagine you've got 4,000 people applying for every single role, the recruiter ideally only wants to have about 10 or 20 CVs that actually come through into their inbox. So they're going to have to filter out thousands of CVs. So what they do is they have the applicant tracking system, and they have certain parameters, and every company will have their own parameters. But essentially, they can create filtering systems, which is a list of must-haves. And if the CV or the applicant does not have those must-haves, they get filtered out of the system. So they can filter on things like nationality, languages, current location, industry, salary, like everything they can pretty much filter on these days. So if you are not matching that criteria, your CV is not even going to land on the recruiter's desk. And there's very little that you can do about that. But a lot of the time it is about keywords. So they can do a CV match rankings parameter. So they take the job description, and the system will look at the CV to see how closely it matches the job description. So you can do the keywords. So it's really important to go through the job description and really look for what are the words that are essential for this job. So if you're a management accountant and you're looking at the job description, and you can see clearly that there are certain things that are coming up again and again and again, and in the sort of essential requirements, it says ACCA qualification or whatever, it's really important that those things really stand out both on your CV and on your LinkedIn profile. But from an online application point of view, it's really about making sure that your CV matches the job as much as possible, bearing in mind this isn't about lying and trying to beat the system through lying. It's about having that sort of emotional intelligence to look at it and say, am I actually a really good match for this job? If I am, how do I communicate that as effectively as I possibly can? You have to tailor your CV to every single job that you apply to. And this is one of the biggest mistakes I see people make, is that they just use one CV and they hope that that's enough. You need to tailor your CV to every single job that you're applying to get that keyword searching as effective as possible. So that's kind of for the online applications. Now, if you're on LinkedIn, a recruiter will actively search for your profile on LinkedIn. So again, making sure that your job titles match the kind of job titles of the jobs that you're looking for. So for example, if you're looking for a customer service role, but your current job title is Chief Happiness Officer, that recruiter is very unlikely going to be typing into LinkedIn Chief Happiness Officer, right?
So, but you know what that job is and what that job entails, but it's exactly not clear to the rest of the world.
It's not, right. So put customer service officer in your job title, and then in brackets put job title Chief Happiness Officer, so that it's both there. But it's, again, it just comes down to making sure that from a search point of view, keywords, qualifications, really making sure that your achievements are very, very clear on your LinkedIn profile, on your CV, all of those things can really help.
Dr. Andrew's been in touch, Dita, saying, hi, Helen, I understand that only 10% of jobs are ever advertised. Most jobs are secured through personal networks. Does Zita agree?
I don't know where that statistic came from. I think it's someone just kind of plucked it out of thin air, to be honest, because I think everyone's got different statistics. But the underlying essence of it is that most people do find their job through either a referral, a recommendation, or through their network. And this is why when I'm still working with my clients, we do allocate a certain amount of time during the day to look at online jobs, et cetera, but we absolutely allocate more time to building a network and nourishing the network that we already have, and really reaching out to people and having a chat about what it is that you're looking for and asking for help, but also building the future network.
Mm-hmm. And presumably, yes, there are job portals that might have job listings, but there are also a source of information and potential contacts as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing about the job adverts is that a lot of them are fake. Recruiters and companies are just trying to test the waters, and they're trying to figure out who's, you know, what kind of talent's in the talent pool at the moment. So what I normally say is use it as a source of information in terms of figuring out who is hiring. So even though you don't know for a fact if they're hiring or not, just take it as I'm assuming that these guys are hiring. And if they're hiring, it might mean that they have a hiring budget generally, which means they could potentially create a role for me, even if the roles that they are advertising right now doesn't match what I do. So then you can go onto Google, onto LinkedIn, et cetera, and try to figure out who are the hiring managers. for these particular roles that I want to apply to, and then reach out to them specifically and say, look, I understand that your company is hiring right now, which means you may have this objective or you may have this pain point, and this is how I can add value to that particular area.
And when it comes to building that network, obviously online is probably the most convenient right now, given the pandemic situation. But
sure.
Is there opportunity to grow a network offline right now?
I think it depends on the, but it's a personal choice, really. I think with everything that's happening right now and the amount of risk that you're willing to take, but also are other people willing to take the risk from their point of view? I have seen some networking events taking place, obviously very small, but still an opportunity to network. So I think there are opportunities. I think you just have to look out for them. But again, it's up to you. It's a personal choice whether or not you want to take that risk.
Now, you mentioned earlier the importance of customising your CV, your application for every single job. Yes, time consuming, but ultimately time well spent.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about, instead of emailing your CV, some of the more creative approaches that might get you noticed amid those, I was going to say hundreds, but given your earlier message about there being thousands of applications for every job right now, what kind of sneaky ways could we perhaps rise to the top of the pile?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's about sneaky ways of getting into the top of the pile. I think it's actually about exploring all of the different ways of getting in front of that employer. But if we're specifically looking at email or sending something, don't just focus on the CV. If you have other things that showcase your work, send those as well. So that might be a PowerPoint presentation. It might be something that you've designed, a mock-up. It may be an article that you've written. It might be a financial model that you've created, some kind of system design. Send that across, because that's a visual thing, and the mind loves visual things, and it will stand you out, and it will the reader will remember you more than other applicants. There was this beautiful example years ago where someone applied to GQ magazine for an internship. I'm not sure if you saw this, because it was on the news, but he took a GQ magazine cover and created a CV out of it. So he put his face as the kind of on the center
model.
Of this GQ, on the, yeah, exactly. And then all around it, he just kind of wrote little things about himself, his achievements, etc. And he got the job that way. It was creative. It was different. It was bold. It was daring. And he got him noticed. So it comes down to your comfort zone. And are you really wishing, or are you really willing to push yourself out of those barriers?
We did hear earlier in this year about a gentleman who applied for a job at a food delivery company by sending them food, which I thought was a fantastic way of getting attention. So
exactly.
I know it can feel like absolute drudgery, spending 5-6 hours a day applying for jobs. But
yeah.
What would be your big overarching message for anyone who is feeling desperate, who is feeling demotivated?
Reach out for help. It's such a difficult thing, because I've been in this position. I lost my job in 2008 during the financial crisis. And again, that was a job scarce market. So I fully empathize with a lot of the job seekers right now. But when you reach out for help, it removes a lot of the stress, because you don't feel so alone anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's the stress that's actually going to stop you from getting the result that you're looking for, because it will leave you paralyzed, or you'll end up going to job interviews and you'll be an absolute mess. So reach out for help. Reach out to your network, people that you've worked with in the past, your ex-bosses, your ex-colleagues, because the fact that you've worked with them means that they can actually recommend you. They can say, I've worked with this person and I can recommend them. Whereas when you reach out to your friends, they've never worked with you. They don't know what you can do, and they don't know what it's like to work with you. So it's a bit more uncomfortable for them to recommend you. So reach out to your existing network, continue to build your network. Apply if you want, but do it with zero expectation. If you are putting or hedging all of your bets on the online application, every time you don't get a response, you're at risk of feeling disappointed, which is just going to leave you demotivated. So apply, but just have zero expectation and manage your time. Do the things that work better. So at the end of every month, do an assessment. What worked? What didn't work? And what could I be doing differently? Or what could I be doing more of? And what should I be doing less of? And just continuously monitor yourself. But really, it's all about the networking. So with LinkedIn specifically, if you send a connection request to somebody and you say, hi, I'm looking for a job, automatically it's nothing for them because they get that message 60,000 times a day. But if you can connect with them on a much deeper level and say, I really love your content, or I really loved the YouTube interview I saw of you, or I really loved this because I saw that, you're connecting with them on a human level. Mm-hmm. And if you can connect with them on a human level, they feel as if you're respecting them as a human being. And that's a really great way to start a relationship. If you can continue to nurture that relationship, at some point, it will be safe enough for you to start to talk about what are the potential opportunities within your organization. And because you've taken the time and you've respected them, they'll be more likely to help you.
Great advice, Zita Yawa. Thank you so, so much, Zita, the career coach, life coach, executive coach.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai Eye 103.8.
And it's Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer. Tune in from Sunday, 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock. We'll be talking family matters, children's health, education, parenting and more. See you then.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.